Chapter 29. Miss Crawley at home, about this time there drove up to an exceedingly snug and well-appointed house in Park Lane, a traveling chariot with a lozenge on the panels, a discontented female in a green veil and crimped curls on the rumble, and a large and confidential man on the box. It was the equipage of our friend Miss Crawley, returning from Hants. The carriage windows were shut. The fat spaniel, whose head and tongue ordinarily lolled out of one of them, reposed on the lap of the discontented female. When the vehicle stopped, a large round bundle of shawls was taken out of the carriage by the aid of various domestics, and a young lady who accompanied the heap of cloaks. That bundle contained Miss Crawley, who was conveyed upstairs forthwith, and put into a bed and chamber warmed properly as for the reception of an invalid. Messengers went off for her physician and medical man. They came, consulted, prescribed, vanished. The young companion of Miss Crawley, at the conclusion of their interview, came in to receive their instructions and administered those antiphlogistic medicines which the eminent men ordered. Captain Crawley of the Life Guards rode up from Knightsbridge Barracks the next day. His black charger pawed the straw before his invalid aunt's door. He was most affectionate in his inquiries regarding that amiable relative. There seemed to be much source of apprehension. He found Miss Crawley's maid, the discontented female, unusually sulky and despondent. He found Miss Briggs, her dame de compagnie, in tears alone in the drawing room. As he had hastened home, hearing of her beloved friend's illness, she wished to fly to her couch, that couch which she, Briggs, had so often smoothed in the hour of sickness. She was denied admission to Miss Crawley's apartment. A stranger was administering her medicines, a stranger from the country, an odious miss. Tears choked the utterance of the dame de compagnie, and she buried her crushed affections and her poor old red nose in her pocket handkerchief. Rawdon Crawley sent up his name by the sulky femme de chambre, and Miss Crawley's new companion, coming tripping down from the sick room, put a little hand into his as he stepped forward eagerly to meet her, gave a glance of great scorn at the bewildered Briggs, and beckoning the young guardsman out of the back drawing room, led him downstairs into that now desolate dining parlor, where so many a good dinner had been celebrated. Here these two talked for 10 minutes, discussing, no doubt, the symptoms of the old invalid above stairs. At the end of which period the parlor bell was rung briskly, and answered on that instant by Mr. Bowles, Miss Crawley's large confidential butler, who, indeed, happened to be at the keyhole during the most part of the interview, and the captain coming out, curling his mustachios, mounted the black charger pawing among the straw, to the admiration of the little blackguard boys collected in the street. He looked in at the dining room window, managing his horse, which curveted and capered beautifully. For one instant the young person might be seen at the window, when her figure vanished, and, doubtless, she went upstairs again, to resume the affecting duties of benevolence. Who could this young woman be, I wonder? That evening a little dinner for two persons was laid in the dining room when Mrs. Firkin, the lady's maid, pushed into her mistress's apartment, and bustled about there during the vacancy occasioned by the departure of the new nurse, and the latter and Miss Briggs sat down to the neat little meal. Briggs was so much choked by emotion that she could hardly take a morsel of meat. The young person carved a fowl with the utmost delicacy, and asked so distinctly for egg sauce, that poor Briggs, before whom that delicious condiment was placed, started, made a great clattering with the ladle, and once more fell back in the most gushing hysterical state. "Had you not better give Miss Briggs a glass of wine?" said the person to Mr. Bowles, the large confidential man. He did so. Briggs seized it mechanically, gasped it down convulsively, moaned a little, and began to play with the chicken on her plate. "I think we shall be able to help each other," said the person with great suavity, "colon, and shall have no need of Mr. Bowles' kind services. Mr. Bowles, if you please, we will ring when we want you." He went downstairs, where, by the way, he vented the most horrid curses upon the unoffending footman, his subordinate. "It is a pity you take on so, Miss Briggs," the young lady said, with a cool, slightly sarcastic air. "My dearest friend is so ill, and woe-oh-on see me," gurgled out Briggs, in an agony of renewed grief. "She's not very ill anymore. Console yourself, dear Miss Briggs. She has only overeaten herself, that is all. She is greatly better. She will soon be quite restored again. She is weak from being cupped, and from medical treatment, but she will rally immediately. Pray console yourself, and take a little more wine." "But why won't she see me again?" Miss Briggs bleated out. "Oh, Matilda, Matilda, after 23 years tenderness, is this the return to your poor, poor Arabella?" "Don't cry too much, poor Arabella," the other said, with ever so little of a grin. "She only won't see you, because she says you don't nurse her as well as I do. It's no pleasure to me to sit up all night. I wish you might do it instead." "Have I not tended that dear couch for years?" Arabella said, "and now she prefers somebody else. Well, sick people have these fancies, and must be humored. When she's well I shall go." "Never, never," Arabella exclaimed, madly inhaling her salts bottle. "Never be well or never go, Miss Briggs," the other said, with the same provoking good nature. "Ooh, she will be well in a fortnight, when I shall go back to my little pupils at Queen's Crawley, and to their mother, who is a great deal more sick than our friend. You need not be jealous about me, my dear Miss Briggs. I am a poor little girl without any friends, or any harm in me. I don't want to supplant you in Miss Crawley's good graces. She will forget me a week after I am gone. And her affection for you has been the work of years. Give me a little wine if you please, my dear Miss Briggs, and let us be friends. I'm sure I want friends." The placable and soft-hearted Briggs speechlessly pushed out her hand at this appeal, but she felt the desertion most keenly for all that, and bitterly, bitterly moaned the fickleness of her Matilda. At the end of half an hour, the meal over, Miss Rebecca Sharp, for such, astonishing to state, is the name of her who has been described ingeniously as the person hitherto, went upstairs again to her patient's rooms, from which, with the most engaging politeness, she eliminated poor Firkin. "Tea, thank you, Mrs. Firkin, that will quite do. How nicely you make it. I will ring when anything is wanted." "Tea, thank you." And Firkin came downstairs in a tempest of jealousy, only the more dangerous, because she was forced to confine it in her own bosom. Could it be the tempest which, as she passed the landing of the first floor, blew open the drawing room door? No, it was stealthily opened by the hand of Briggs. Briggs had been on the watch. Briggs too well heard the creaking Firkin descend the stairs, and the clink of the spoon and gruel basin the neglected female carried. "Well, Firkin?" says she, as the other entered the apartment. "Well, Jane?" "Wuss and wuss," Miss B. Firkin said, wagging her head. "Is she not better then?" She never spoke but once, and I asked her if she felt a little more easy, and she told me to hold my stupid tongue. Oh, Miss B., I never thought to have seen this day. And the waterworks again began to play. What sort of a person is this Miss Sharp, Firkin? I little thought, while enjoying my Christmas revels in the elegant home of my firm friends, the Reverend Lionel Delamere and his amiable lady, to find a stranger had taken my place in the affections of my dearest, my still dearest Matilda. Miss Briggs, it will be seen by her language, was of a literary and sentimental turn, and had once published a volume of poems, Rills of the Nightingale, by subscription. "Miss B., they are all infatuated about that young woman," Firkin replied. "Sir Pitt wouldn't have let her go, but he daren't refuse Miss Crawley anything. Mrs. Bute at the rectory just as bad, never happy out of her sight. The captain quite wild about her. Mr. Crawley Marshall jealous. Since Miss C. was took ill, she won't have nobody near her but Miss Sharp. I can't tell for where nor for why, and I think something has bewitched everybody. Rebecca passed that night in constant watching upon Miss Crawley. The next night the old lady slept so comfortably that Rebecca had time for several hours' comfortable repose herself on the sofa at the foot of her patroness's bed. Very soon, Miss Crawley was so well that she sat up and laughed heartily at a perfect imitation of Miss Briggs and her grief, which Rebecca described to her. Briggs' weeping snuffle and her manner of using the handkerchief were so completely rendered that Miss Crawley became quite cheerful, to the admiration of the doctors when they visited her, who usually found this worthy woman of the world, when the least sickness attacked her, under the most abject depression and terror of death. Captain Crawley came every day, and received bulletins from Miss Rebecca respecting his aunt's health. This improved so rapidly that poor Briggs was allowed to see her patroness. And persons with tender hearts may imagine the smothered emotions of that sentimental female, and the affecting nature of the interview. Miss Crawley liked to have Briggs in a good deal soon. Rebecca used to mimic her to her face with the most admirable gravity, thereby rendering the imitation doubly piquant to her worthy patroness. The causes which had led to the deplorable illness of Miss Crawley, and her departure from her brother's house in the country, were of such an unromantic nature that they are hardly fit to be explained in this genteel and sentimental novel. For how is it possible to hint of a delicate female, living in good society, that she ate and drank too much, and that a hot supper of lobsters profusely enjoyed at the rectory, was the reason of an indisposition which Miss Crawley herself persisted was solely attributable to the dampness of the weather? The attack was so sharp that Matilda, as his reverence expressed it, was very nearly off the hooks. All the family were in a fever of expectation regarding the will, and Rawdon Crawley was making sure of at least £40,000 before the commencement of the London season. Mr. Crawley sent over a choice parcel of tracts to prepare her for the change from Vanity Fair and Park Lane for another world, but a good doctor from Southampton, being called in time, vanquished the lobster which was so nearly fatal to her, and gave her sufficient strength to enable her to return to London. The baronet did not disguise his exceeding mortification at the turn which affairs took. While everybody was attending on Miss Crawley, and messengers every hour from the rectory were carrying news of her health to the affectionate folks there was a lady in another part of the house, being exceedingly ill, of whom no one took any notice at all, and this was the lady of Crawley herself. The good doctor shook his head after seeing her, to which visit Sir Pitt consented, as it could be paid without a fee, and she was left fading away in her lonely chamber, with no more heed paid to her than to a weed in the park. The young ladies, too, lost much of the inestimable benefit of their governess's instruction. So affectionate a nurse was Miss Sharp, that Miss Crawley would take her medicines from no other hand. Firkin had been deposed long before her mistress's departure from the country. That faithful attendant found a gloomy consolation on returning to London, in seeing Miss Briggs suffer the same pangs of jealousy, and undergo the same faithless treatment to which she herself had been subject. Captain Rawdon got an extension of leave on his aunt's illness, and remained dutifully at home. He was always in her anticamer. She lay sick in the state bedroom, into which he entered by the little blue saloon. His father was always meeting him there, or if he came down the corridor ever so quietly, his father's door was sure to open, and the hyena face of the old gentleman to glare out. What was it set one to watch the other so? A generous rivalry, no doubt, as to which should be most attentive to the dear sufferer in the state bedroom. Rebecca used to come out and comfort both of them, or one or the other of them rather. Both of these worthy gentlemen were most anxious to have news of the invalid from her little confidential messenger. At dinner, to which meal she descended for half an hour, she kept the peace between them, after which she disappeared for the night, when Rawdon would ride over to the depot of the 150th at Mudbury, leaving his papa to the society of Mr. Horrocks and his rum and water. She passed as weary a fortnight as ever mortal spent in Miss Crawley's sick room, but her little nerves seemed to be of iron, as she was quite unshaken by the duty and the tedium of the sick chamber. She never told until long afterwards how painful that duty was, how peevish a patient was the jovial old lady, how angry, how sleepless, in what horrors of death, during what long nights she lay moaning, and in almost delirious agonies respecting that future world which she quite ignored when she was in good health. Picture to yourself, O fair young reader, a worldly, selfish, graceless, thankless, religionless old woman, writhing in pain and fear, and without her wig. Picture her to yourself, and ere you be old, learn to love and pray. Sharp watched this graceless bedside with indomitable patience. Nothing escaped her, and, like a prudent steward, she found a use for everything. She told many a good story about Miss Crawley's illness in after days, stories which made the lady blush through her artificial carnations. During the illness she was never out of temper, always alert. She slept light, having a perfectly clear conscience, and could take that refreshment at almost any minute's warning, and so you saw very few traces of fatigue in her appearance. Her face might be a trifle paler, and the circles round her eyes a little blacker than usual, but whenever she came out from the sick room she was always smiling, fresh, and neat, and looked as trim in her little dressing gown and cap, as in her smartest evening suit. The captain thought so, and raved about her in uncouth convulsions. The barbed shaft of love had penetrated his dull hide. 6 weeks' apropinquity opportunity had victimized him completely. He made a confidant of his aunt at the rectory, of all persons in the world. She rallied him about it. As he had perceived his folly, she warned him. She finished by owning that little Sharp was the most clever, droll, odd, good-natured, simple, kindly creature in England. Rawdon must not trifle with her affections, though dear Miss Crawley would never pardon him for that, for she, too, was quite overcome by the little governess, and loved Sharp like a daughter. Rawdon must go away, go back to his regiment and naughty London, and not play with a poor artless girl's feelings. Many and many a time this good-natured lady, compassionating the forlorn life guardsman's condition, gave him an opportunity of seeing Miss Sharp at the rectory, and of walking home with her, as we have seen. When men of a certain sort, ladies, are in love, though they see the hook and the string, and the whole apparatus with which they are to be taken, they gorge the bait nevertheless they must come to it, they must swallow it, and are presently struck and landed gasping. Rawdon saw there was a manifest intention on Mrs. Bute's part to captivate him with Rebecca. He was not very wise, but he was a man about town, and had seen several seasons. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.